hit your second shot first. Version 2.0 by Jim Flynn. Any opinions expressed within are merely that of the author and are not meant to be taken seriously by the individuals, their representatives, or their lawyers. Copyright 2021 by Jim Flynn. All rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or used in any manner without written permission of the copyright owner, except for the use of quotations in a book review. Forward. After releasing the first edition of this book, I received many comments, most of them complimentary. Sales of the book are great. Some days I'm a best-selling author. But some of the comments went something like this. Dear, one or more words. I enjoy the book. It's funny. But how about a more specific answer on how to hit your second shot first? I wrote the first edition to be funny. It's easy to make fun of rich, pretentious people who take themselves too seriously. Golf is an easy target. But I did promise to make golfers better. So I started to think about, what's a better answer? How do you hit your second shot first? I had identified the problem, but I didn't have the answer right. This edition has two objectives. First, to entertain, to make people laugh. And second, to help readers and me improve their golf scores. I embarked on new research, interviewing a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a brain surgeon, and a neurologist. All of them play golf. I talked to a pro golfer who gives lessons. I took notes. Are you familiar with the saying, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail? It was like that. After careful study of their opinions, I concluded, none of them has a clue. I read psychology books, golf books. Nothing helped. I recently published golf book is so complex that if you tried to execute all the things the author suggests, you wouldn't be able to play at all. One psychology website recommends soaking in a warm bath as a way for golfers to relax. I didn't think that would work well in the course. Then, playing one day, I was taking a mulligan, hitting my second shot second under combat conditions. I hit a perfect shot. The answer came to me. Clouds parted, a beam of sunshine hit me, and divine harp music played. Not really, but I did have a revelation. I will share this. One reader emailed me and said, "Hit your second shot first was a complete waste of time and money." My reply, "Other than that, how'd you enjoy the book?" I haven't heard back. I suggest that reader give their copy of the first edition to someone with a sense of humor and buy the more helpful edition for themselves. I did go back and read all the reviews, emails, and blog posts. There's a natural tendency to read just the good ones, but I force myself to look at the bad ones. There are some trolls who make their days by giving bad reviews to everything. But most of the people were being honest. How could I improve the book for the people who didn't like it and add more for majority of readers who had given positive feedback? So this is the new improved version 2.0 of Hit Your Second Shot First. My new discovery has caused me to make revisions throughout the book. And the big answer is at the end. Have some fun reading this, but think about it, and your game may improve. As you read the book, your mind will be opened. Also new are groundbreaking discussions on the cultural significance of cargo shorts, an explanation of certain golf-related TV commercials, and an analysis of how long a French fry can stay on your floor mat and still be eaten. So it's a philosophical tour de force. When you complete the book, please take time to leave a review. Feel free to email me, sincerejimmy942@gmail.com. Introduction, hit your second shot first. Did you ever hit such a terrible tee shot that the people you are playing with take pity on you and let you hit a second shot, a mulligan, even though no such agreement was made before the round? Golf experts are always yakking at you in books. Most of the advice they give you, sight unseen, makes you play worse. The experts can't relate to taking a mulligan. It's beneath them. For example, they say the reason you hit your mulligan, your second shot, much better than your terrible first shot is, the pressure was off. Under their breath, you pathetic creature. They're wrong. They couldn't be any more wrong. Think about it. As you stand there with people watching you, after you've royally screwed up, there's more pressure. So, what's the answer? Read the book. Let's go back to your playing partners giving you the mulligan. Let me make this clear. Your opponents want to beat you. That's fine. But even so, they take pity on you. It's no fun beating you if you're this pathetic. What usually happens then? Well, in my case, my second shot is generally good and solid, down the middle of the fairway. Why? What happened between the first and the second shot? Understanding that is the key to enlightenment. How do you get to the point where you don't need that first pathetic shot to set up the second good shot? In other words, hit your second shot first. You've got a lot of work to do to get there. One of the terms and conditions of the guarantee is that you have to read this book. Chapter 1. Golf as a morality play and an intelligence test. There will be times while reading this book that you are asked to be honest, to admit things. There are deep-seated psychological reasons for your poor golf performance. The good news is you must make admissions only to yourself, not to a psychiatrist or group therapy session. Golf has stacked major psychological obstacles in your way. Many of the obstacles just happened from the way golf evolved, but some of the problems are man-made conspiracies. There's not going to be a Supreme Court case on this or anything, but you just should know about it. Let's dispel a couple of thoughts that are commonly floating around the overcrowded and disorganized mind of the average golfer. 1. The primary reason you are not achieving your goals as a golfer, you are a bad person. That's not true. Not to say that you're a good person either. It just doesn't matter if you're a good or bad person. Golf is not some karma-balancing mechanism that punishes you for all the bad things that you have done in life, nor does it reward you for all those wonderful, selfless things that you have done. Excluding myself, most people I know have done a lot more bad things anyhow. So it's great for the majority of people that golf is a neutral, disinterested observer of your moral balance sheet. For example, Mother Teresa never won any majors. She never even made the cut in a major tournament. Okay, then it must be 2. The primary reason you are not achieving your goals as a golfer, you are stupid. This is also not true. For one thing, you bought this book, and that proves a certain level of intelligence. Yet I have personally heard medical doctors, dentists, lawyers, self-made rich guys, artists, software developers, and many other people who society considers smart say, "You bleeping stupid idiot, moron, imbecile," and other similar words when they hit a bad shot. As in the first example, it doesn't matter if you're stupid. Golf doesn't care about that either. Golf is a cold-hearted mistress. Now, that's a little heavy-handed, but you get the point. There is even one school of thought that believe that it is to your advantage in golf if you are a little stupid. We'll explore that. This book is fun. I hope you agree. But there's a method to that madness. Golf should be fun, but it's more fun if you don't stink. There's a more serious theme as well. The first step toward getting better is changing the way you think. But it's not that difficult. You do need an open mind, and the golf community has been working against you for as long as you've been playing. We'll start here. All golfers are delusional. That may not be true. I just haven't met any of them who aren't. I'll get it kicked off. My name is Jim, and I'm a delusional golfer. Go ahead. Say it out loud. My name is, state your name, and I'm a delusional golfer. That wasn't that bad, was it? I know people. Some of you didn't say it out loud. Go back. Say you're a delusional golfer out loud. We'll never be cured. We have to fight being delusional every round, every shot. It's a question of degree. If we can just be a little less delusional, we'll play a lot better. For example, you might be having your best round of the year. When after six holes, you walk up to the seventh tee and decide to put a little extra on your tee shot. I play with guys who are actually dumb enough to say out loud, "Hey, watch this!" You watch, all right, as your pathetic tee shot plops into the pond 15 yards from the tee. If you don't put the wheels back on, the best round of the year turns into a horror house of nightmares. What made you do that? Delusion bubbled up to the surface. This book will give you the training to suppress your unrealistic impulses. Let's get serious here for a second and review. Why did you hit your mulligan better? The expert yakkers say it because you relax, that the pressure is off. Remember, they couldn't be any more wrong. Discussing questions for Chapter 1. A vital part of this book is that each chapter will have discussion questions. It gets you to participate. It's important to fill out the answer to each question with a pen for two reasons. One, it shows a level of commitment. Two, you're going to write things that if other people saw them would be embarrassing. So if you want to recommend this book to anybody, they're going to have to buy a new copy. But it's private, and better than having to stand up from your folding chair at a meeting in a church basement saying, "My name is Bob, and I am a delusional golfer." The following two questions will prove the points in Chapter 1. Question 1. Write down the first and last name of persons you play golf with or personally know who are terrible individuals, just bad people who are better at golf than you. Don't hold back. Write legibly in pen what you really think of them. Cite examples of their bad behavior on and off the golf course. Dig deep. Admit that you can't stand certain fellow golfers that, due to societal pressures, you are forced to pretend to like. Don't be afraid to mention friends, relatives, members of the clergy, clients, regular playing partners, or that guy with the Jaguar who takes up two parking spaces so his precious convertible won't get scratched. If you're employed, it's completely fine to put your boss on this list. It's okay to write the name of your boss's nephew who got the promotion you deserved. Question 2. Write down, in pen, the first and last names of stupid people you know who are better at golf than you. It's permissible to repeat names you use as answers to question 1. Nobody's going to see this. Really? Spill your guts. After considering this list, do you agree with the school of thought that believes that being a little stupid helps people with their golf games? Do you feel better already? Isn't this liberating? It's your commencement of the mental clarification process so you can start with a clean slate. This is just the beginning of opening your mind to the exploration into the psychology of golf and how you, yes, even you, can conquer it. By the way, this is not a self-help book. If you could self-help, you'd already be better. You need outside help. Admit it. Note, early test readers of this book have complained that there's not enough space on these pages to write their entire lists of bad and stupid people. So feel free to write anywhere in the book, first using the inside of the front and back covers. Remember, This is your personal copy of the book. You're not going to give it to anybody, right? This multifunctional book will also provide, at no extra cost, the valuable free service of suggesting new, more realistic golf rule changes designed to make play faster, fairer, and more enjoyable. Clearing your mind of these distractions will get you started on the road to hitting your second shot first. These suggestions will be at the end of selected chapters. Surprisingly, I haven't heard any or gotten any feedback from the USGA yet. Suggested rule change number one. A member of a foursome tees up a ball, and as the player addresses it, the ball inadvertently falls off the tee. If another member of the foursome says, "That's one," as though this is something humorous and hasn't already been said 400 billion times this year, then it's okay for the other three members of the foursome to beat the quipster to death with their putters. This is also applies to threesomes. Bonus questions. Should this rule apply to twosomes, even though there are no corroborating witnesses? Remember that the victim's whiny family may report you to the authorities, so have your story lined up. You were just following the rules. Then again, the family might be fed up with the perpetrator telling the same dumb joke for years on end and glad to be rid of him. Related bonus question. Should a putter necessarily be used as the weapon? Some have suggested using drivers because the golfer on the tee is probably already holding a driver. Others think wedges would be more lethal. Responsible spokesperson for all viewpoints will be heard on this important issue. Double point bonus round. Philosophical ethics question. In the Ryder Cup, as a patriotic American, is it okay if I don't root for Patrick Reed if he's playing against somebody I do like, for example, Rory McIlroy? After all, Rory isn't from North Korea or anything. Remember, the most important path to success is realizing that you're delusional and learning a method to change the way you think. Stop fighting me on this. The top golfers at the place you play are not delusional, but they are keeping this secret. They don't want you to know. You've got to change. Before we try to make that change, let's explore how a golf champion thinks and compare and contrast that to how you think. Chapter 2, The Mind of a Golfing Champion. The former Amanda Baleonis, now Mrs. Renner, is the woman who interviews golfers on CBS after they have finished their rounds. She is known for being always cheerful and smiley. But beneath the bubbly personality is a very skilled interviewer. Professional golfers are not always the most talkative people, especially when Amanda has to talk to one of them after he's missed a few putts on the closing holes of the tournament, moved five slots down the leaderboard, and just blown, say, $600,000 in winnings. Even though that's the equivalent of you and me losing $20, it still bothers the pro a bit. He might have to hold off on upgrading the private jet for a couple of weeks. And his wife just mentioned that the new 12,000-square-foot house is barely adequate. One day, Amanda was interviewing Brooks Koepka, who had just won. He was happy. But Brooks can be a laconic guy. He was giving one- and two-word answers. It was like pulling teeth for Amanda. But skilled interviewers know not to ask yes or no questions. To get somebody to talk, ask open questions. Why? When? How? That sort of thing. They were reviewing video of his key shots on the closing holes. Amanda. Brooks, as you prepared to hit this crucial shot across the water on the 18th hole, which you eventually hit to 3 feet from the pin, what were you thinking about? Brooks. Nothing. That was his answer. He shrugged. Amanda laughed. Brooks laughed. It was a fun moment. But it gave an interesting insight to the mind of one of the world's best professional golfers, a winner of multiple major championships. There's a guy who can clear his mind. Ethics question. Did you ever go to the drive-thru at McDonald's and order a fillet of fish? Then they handed you the wrong bag, which contained three Big Macs? Did you just drive away? Discussion question one. What do you think Brooks Koepka would do in the above-referenced situation? Discussion question two. What is the longest elapsed time between you dropping a French fry on your car's floor and you finding and eating it? This may not seem like an important question, but it's a test of your honesty. You must be honest to yourself to successfully use this book. If the answer is longer than 2 days, you may also need help in other areas. Suggested rule change number 2. You know that guy you play with who's too slow? And now he just got a newfangled electronic rangefinder. After his drive, the ball is right next to the 150-yard marker, but he insists on getting his rangefinder out. He initially holds it backwards, so it takes a long time for him to announce, "I'm not 150 yards. It's exactly 152 yards. Eventually, he hits the ball. He tops it. The ball rolls 3 feet. He pushes his cart up to his ball, then gets the rangefinder out again. Before he hits the next shot, it's required to beat him to death with your putter. Chapter 3, Your Mind. To make it easier to explore your mind, let's create a fantasy situation. For the purposes of our fantasy, let's imagine that the wonderful Mrs. Baleonis Renner has committed a terrible crime and has been sentenced to a work-release program, forced to interview golfers like you as her punishment. Part of her sentence? She has to pretend that you are interesting. Just prior to your interview, you have blown the lead of the pathetic Class D Open, a little tournament at your club, by hitting a screaming line drive into the water on the 18th hole when a nice, easy wedge to the green would have virtually put the tournament trophy in your hands. You had been hitting your wedge just great all day up until that point. A real jerk who you can't stand won the tournament and is celebrating by drinking beer out of the trophy on the practice green. The thing that really bothers you is that he used to be your friend, your best friend, until in a very unsportsmanlike manner, he beat you today by not hitting his ball in the water on 18. Here's the interview. Amanda, so, write your name in pen in blank space. What were you thinking as you prepared to hit that crucial shot over the water on the 18th hole? Your name. Well, Amanda, I was thinking I had a downhill lie. I tried to remember what Ben Hogan said about downhill lies in the book Five Lessons. Or was it Golf Digest? It was something about changing your grip, either make it stronger or weaker. I couldn't remember. Then I wondered about the position of my wrist. When did that pond get so big? Did my shoelaces need to be tighter? I always have trouble with downhill lies. Why didn't I hit my prior shot to the right side where the fairway's level? Why am I so stupid? Am I a bad person? Do I not deserve to win? Am I being punished for being happy that my opponent missed that 3-foot putt? I wondered, where did I leave my car keys? Was I predestined not to win? Then I thought about the takeaway. Should I? Amanda, interrupting after listening to her headset. Sorry, your name. I have to cut you off there. The director is telling me the world is running out of electricity. The TV lights go dim. Amanda lowers her microphone. Your name. Can I finish telling you, Amanda, even though we are no longer recording? Amanda. No. She calls out, Security? Hey, Rocky, would you please escort this guy away from me? Discussion question 1. Admit it. I am reading your mind. That's exactly what you'd be thinking, but some of the thoughts have been edited due to time constraints. What do you have to say for yourself? Discussion question 2. When is the last time you choked like that? Did you play today? Discussion question 3. How do you turn your mind off like Brooks Koepka? Related fact. In my research for the revised edition, I found 23 books on Amazon that are at least partially titled How Not to Overthink. I read parts of them. The books were not helpful. They might as well have suggested you take a warm bath on the golf course. But it is clear overthinking has been identified as a problem. Chapter 4. Hit your second shot first. Do you play golf under almost any conditions? For example, 1. I know it's a tornado warning, but just a small tornado. 2. I know it may snow, but I putt well in the snow. 3. I know there's an alligator on the left side of the fairway. I'll just aim to the right side. But despite the dedication, your game doesn't get any better. Let's go back to our opening example of the unexpected mulligan. Understanding that is the key to unlocking your true potential. What happened there? Why was my first shot so bad? Why was my second shot so good? It's not because I was a bad person 5 seconds ago and just got to be a good person, and it's not that my IQ improved. These issues were discussed in Chapter 1. Before we go any further, if you follow the advice in this book, your game will improve. The improvement may be so astounding that you'll be ashamed that you paid only a token fee for the book. Any additional payments generated by the gratitude you feel may be sent to the author. Recommended giving level, 100% of your first year winnings. Please see email contact information to facilitate payment. You're on the honor system. I have become enlightened after years of study, a PhD in performance psychology from the Sorbonne, and using my own teachings, I have become a scratch golfer who has won numerous state and regional championships. People from around the world pay thousands of dollars to attend my summer seminars at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And the client list includes some of the world's highest rated male and female golfers, CEOs of major companies, Academy Award winners, and Nobel Prize laureates. Let me make just one thing clear. Nothing in the above paragraph is true. But every golf psychology book starts off with a paragraph bragging like the one above. You've read some of them. Have they made your game better? And the books are so serious as though your golf game is important in the cosmic scale of the universe. I'm really not that great. I mentally fight the issues that are discussed in this book. However, I do have spurts of adequacy and did embark on a quest of admittedly unconventional forms of study on the art and science of golf. If the conventional baloney is not helping you, maybe this will. I have watched a lot of golf on TV, an hour after hour of YouTube videos, along with reading a couple of books. I play often, so I think I'm highly qualified to tell you what to do. I do have very keen powers of observation and very unselfish about correcting players' partners' golf swing mistakes even in mid-round. Some people are so sensitive and rude. I'm just trying to help. I'm going to say this again. People tell you that the reason your second shot, the mulligan, is good is because the pressure was off. These people are wrong. Let's face it. Most people don't know anything. It's a shame that they're allowed to vote. The main goal is to get you to hit the second shot without having to hit the bad first shot. So, forget about the golf psychologist. I've read a lot of them. One guy even talks about his religious beliefs being a factor. Your religious beliefs are none of my business. But anybody who seriously thinks that a higher power cares if you beat your friends in golf needs help from something other than this book. You're out there by yourself, on your own little island. It's up to you to build the raft and get off. This is such an important point that I want you to pause and think about that for a couple of minutes. Discussion question for Chapter 4. Question 1. I put you on the honor system to send in cash to me based on your improvement as a player. In your case, was I foolish to do that? If you're defending yourself, give examples of times you were generous when nobody else was watching. Question 2. You're not going to send in any money, are you? Even if I take 10 strokes off your handicap? Question 3. Have you ever been examined by a doctor when he said he needed to excuse himself to talk to a colleague? Then he went in the hallway and you could make out parts of the conversation. Did you overhear the term personality disorder? How about delusional egomaniac? Or, this guy's a legend in his own mind. Why am I asking? No reason. Suggested rule change number 3. You know the guy who always tells you what your score is after 17 holes, or 8 holes if you're just playing 9? He's not doing this to be nice. You You know what your score is. He's trying to jinx you. He's a creep. If you have warned him not to do that before the round in front of witnesses, it's okay to beat him to death with your putter if he insists on doing it nevertheless. Bonus question. You can figure out a lot about a person by playing golf with them. What is the minimum number of holes you need to complete a psychological analysis of a new playing partner? As you are analyzing the newbie, please be aware they are analyzing you. If this thought makes you paranoid, remember that sometimes being paranoid is an appropriate state of mind. Chapter 5, It's Not Entirely Your Fault. It's time to make some more admissions of if you expect to improve as a player. Let's face it, you hope your opponent misses that 4-foot putt. You hope your opponent misses every putt. You hope your opponent hits the ball into the water. You hope your opponent hits a grounder off the tee. You can't count on those things happening, and this isn't college basketball. You can't stand behind the hole when your opponent is putting and wave a giant foam finger that says, I'm number one, and make a lot of noise. You need a different plan. This book says out loud the usually unspoken thought, every shot makes somebody happy. Your goal is to vastly increase the percentage of your shots that make you happy. Don't make the other guy happy. Don't let them celebrate at your expense. Golf was invented by barbaric Scottish shepherds, barely removed from the Stone Age, but propagated and refined in England by Victorian gents who majored in hypocrisy at Oxford or Cambridge or someplace like that. So since golf is steeped in the phoniness of that age, you are supposed to pretend that you are rooting for your opponents. You must act oh so pleased and amused when your opponent sculls a chip shot that runs along the ground at 80 miles per hour, hits the pin, and goes in the hole. Everybody knows that you're not rooting for them, but you have to act like a good sport. What a marvelous shot, Nigel! Note, one of my grandmothers was born in Scotland, so I speak with authority about the barbarism of the Scots. Hold off on the hate mail, or at least use some restraint, and be brave enough to sign it with your real name and actual email address. Anonymous blog posts should make you ashamed. Real world. Everybody's competitive. If even the smallest sum of money is at stake, they're even more competitive. And that's fine. Just be honest. It's not you against the course or man against nature. You're trying to beat the guy you're playing against. Actual true example. I was recovering from major brain surgery. Yes, really. My first time back on a course was maybe 5 weeks after the procedure. I played 9 holes against a friend of mine, a pillar of his community, a wonderful guy who's on the board of directors of several charities and a couple of religious institutions. He's a much better person than me. Many of my own friends have described me as a self-centered jerk. We made our standard wager, $1. I was wobbly, unsteady, and took a cart to ride on this flat-as-a-pancake course, something I never do in normal circumstances. I probably shouldn't have been out there at all and had to hit with my feet wider apart than usual so I wouldn't fall over. My opponent was very concerned with my physical condition at first, but I could tell he was sure he'd win every hole, and he graciously refused to take my dollar. Maybe he'd generously buy me a coffee and wish me better luck when I fully recovered. But then I parred the first hole to his bogey. As our 9-hole match progressed, I surprised him and myself by hanging in there. I made a couple of long putts. He got tighter and tighter. And after his disastrous 8 on the 8th hole, we were tied. I had the tee on the short but narrow par 4 ninth, and hit a hybrid right down the middle. A perfect shot. I had a wedge to the green. My opponent is a guy who hardly ever cusses. You! Expletive deleted, he said. He meant it. It was a really bad phrase. That compound Anglo-Saxon phrase used by Bruce Willis in major motion pictures. I'm sure my friend never uses it at the board of directors meetings. his Victorian gent golf manners went off the rails, exposing his true competitive nature. Then he unnecessarily teed off with a driver, and he hit his ball 50 yards out of bounds. "Nice shot," I said. As I mentioned, every shot makes somebody happy. Our matches were scheduled early Friday morning before work. I was still working then. My friend was a client of mine, and he was in the habit of telling his secretary, also my client, the results of our matches. He was going to have to go to his office and to tell his secretary that he just lost to a guy who was playing his first golf game after brain surgery. I've been happy lots of times in my life, but I can't remember being happier than the moment when he had to hand me that dollar. The thrill of victory for me, the agony of defeat for him. Some of it was the sense of relief that I could play again, which wasn't certain prior to the operation. But pocketing that dollar was sweet, too. And he had to tell his secretary. So don't tell me that we're all in this together, or that golf is a wonderful fellowship. Winning is better. Special feature. No matter what you do or how you prepare, something like this is going to happen. It's part of the game. You play okay, but don't put away your opponent who stinks when you have multiple chances to do so. Then your opponent, who is getting strokes from you, gets lucky and bounces a shot off a tree that lands 6 inches from the hole on the last green. You both get pars, but since you are giving a shot, the opponent wins the hole and the match. Your opponent celebrates by holding his hands in the air and waving to a non-existent audience. It's hard to say anything nice. Your opponent says something like, "They don't draw pictures on the scorecard, only numbers." He acts as though he's letting you in on a clever original insight. The world is bleak. For the next week, people who see you say, "I heard you lost to your opponent. He was in the bar telling everyone he beat you. He said his game is really dialed in since he got his rangefinder. He did mention that you seem to be past your prime, that maybe you need to work on your grip. He says he's been using the Hogan grip." Discussion questions. Question 1. Admit it. You're a competitive person in all areas of your life. You squeeze your car ahead in rush hour traffic so a little old lady won't be able to cut you off. In your career, you throw a competitor down a flight of stairs if you could get away with it. So why do you think you have to pretend to be rooting for your opponent when you play golf? Question 2. Isn't it intimidating how well I know you? Question 3. Have you noticed that I only tell stories that make me look good? Do you think that's fair? So what? It's my book. Suggested rule change number 4. Each player will be able to carry an electric cattle prod. These reasonably priced devices can be used in several scenarios, including, number 1, in team play. Your partner looks like he's considering attempting a very low probability shot. The shot requires going over water and stopping the ball on a small green. If he refuses to listen to you and goes for the shot, you are allowed to turn on the cattle prod. It makes a humming noise. You can now stand behind him as he addresses the ball, and he knows what's coming if he hits a bad shot. Number 2, another team play scenario. Your partner has been leaving all his putts short. To motivate him, you turn on the cattle prod and stand behind him as he putts. Number 3, be advised, your partner will also be carrying a cattle prod. Number 4, in general, the cattle prod can be seen as an encouragement to speed up slope play. There's a decent chance that reasonably priced cattle prods may be carried in all the online golf superstores after the publication of this book. Admit it, you'd like to get one. Attention readers, I am open to an endorsement deal, so if you know anybody in the electric cattle prod business, I know that some of the new rules seem harsh, but will be fair if uniformly enforced. Eventually you'll thank me, unless you're that guy with a new rangefinder. Note, Some of the readers of this book have suggested that a combination rangefinder cattle prod might be a great product. I'm thinking endorsement deal. Chapter 6, The Golf Swing. Let's face it. If you're going to play golf, you must have a swing of some kind. It's how you eventually get the ball closer to the hole. Otherwise, you're just riding around in the cart. One of the key missions of this book is to convince golfers that they're delusional and to be more realistic about their game. We've got to break you down to rock bottom before we build you up again. That's a big first step on the road to improvement. If you give the vast majority of amateur golfers truth serum, or most of them just a couple of drinks, and ask them to describe their own golf swing, it will be a combination of Ben Hogan, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods. They are convinced of this. Remember what I said about delusional? Money-saving tip. There are some golf schools that will attach electrodes to your body and wire you up to a computer that will analyze the 35 different body movements of your golf swing. It's a lot like a brain scan. Remember, I have experience in this area. You don't have to go to this expense. You don't even have to buy a tripod for your iPhone so you can go out in your backyard and record a few phony swings. Instead, use one of the wonders of technology and go to YouTube. In my tireless research for this book, I have watched for hours at practice ranges and then tried to match up those swings with videos on YouTube. I filtered down thousands of possibilities and identified just three videos that describe your swing. Some amateur swings include combinations of these three techniques. It may be surprising that these videos are not classified under golf on YouTube. Go ahead and just search for them. Number one, Jack Nicholson's character in The Shining, breaking down a door with an axe when he's trying to murder his family. Take special notice of the crazed smile on his face. That's what you look like when you hit a random good shot. If you have an instructor, the swing motion is what he is referring to when he mentions that you come over the top a bit. Number two, a Russian woman hammer thrower, winning the gold medal in 2000 Olympics. Note the footwork. This is what you look like when you overswing. And number three, a man operating a backhoe, digging up a grassy area. This is what you look like on the course under actual playing conditions because you never practice your short game before you play. You just see how far you can hit your driver. The three swings mentioned above have one thing in common. The root cause of each is delusional thinking. Discussion question one. Isn't YouTube great? It can teach you how to do just about anything. One problem, the content creator needs no qualifications as long as they know how to make a video. What's that, you say? What are my qualifications? We've already covered that. Chapter 7, The Special Role of Ben Hogan in his book, Five Lessons in Creating a Nation of Delusional Golfers. There's something called a swing thought. It's what you think about when you are getting ready to and are swinging at the ball. Ben Hogan is said to have used Henny Bogan as his swing thought. Saying his name scrambled like that set up his rhythm. He thought Henny on the backswing and Bogan as he came forward. Many say that Hogan had the greatest pure swing of all time. The perennially best-selling golf book, number one on Amazon right now, is Ben Hogan's Five Lessons. There are over 1 million copies in print. The author doesn't mention his Henny Bogan swing thought in the book. Each of the five essays are as methodical and humorless as a United States manual on the correct method to clean the bore of an M16. The black and white drawings are excellent, but they're very serious. The artwork is reminiscent of illustrations in a medical school anatomy textbook. It's fair to say that Hogan was not known for his sense of humor, and there's no room for deviation from his prescriptions for perfection. One professional reviewer said, Hogan wrote a book about how not to hit a hook for a nation of slicers. That means the book has nothing to do with your game. Yet you were told that Hogan had the greatest swing. So if you don't swing like him, you're a bad person. Trust me, you can't swing like him. The conflict here is what sets golfers on the road to delusional. I'm trying to claw you back. But Five Lessons has almost entirely rave reviews written by amateurs on Amazon. Thousands of reviews. Many of the reviewers casually mention that they still stink as golfers. But they're trying and trying to be like Ben Hogan. And they're going to keep trying. They read the book and go out and hit ground balls and big banana slices. They are petrified of a sand trap. They can't get out of one. It must be their fault. Their mind do not have the means to translate the drawings and Five Lessons to actions on a golf course, and their bodies can't do the movements that Ben describes any more than they could look at an illustrated book by Eric Clapton and pick up a guitar and play like him. So why do they think Five Lessons is great? Because people have been told these are the fundamental tenets written in stone. There is no deviation. If they just read the book again, for the 14th time, maybe they'll absorb the magic somehow. It's interesting that Hogan's book still dominates golf book sales. Hogan stopped playing in competition in the early 1960s and died in 1997, while many others, Jack, Arnie, Gary, Tiger, and Lesser Lights, have written books about how to play. But Ben is strict. You must do it his way. It ties into the original guilt trip of golf. So people who have read the book but can't play worth a lick pass Five Lessons down to new generations who also can't play. Millions of people who never looked at the book are influenced indirectly by the vibe which had permeated throughout golf. This is serious. There's only one right way to swing. Admission time again. If you think that reading Five Lessons will make you swing like Hogan, admit that you are delusional. Delusional means you're not being realistic. Hogan's book says you must grip the club this way. You must stand this way. You must begin the downswing this way. There's a lot of must in that book. Hogan philosophy, one size fits all. You must swing like this. But the best guy I play with doesn't grip the club that way, stands too far away from the ball for Ben's liking, and his swing doesn't look anything like the precision drawings in Hogan's book. He's never looked at Five Lessons. Others I play with who read and reread Hogan can't break 100 lest they cheat. Cheating isn't mentioned as a strategy in Five Lessons, but we'll discuss the psychology and creative uses of cheating later on. After conducting the same kind of careful scientific analysis already discussed, I've reached the following conclusions. Here's all you must do if you want to swing like Hogan. 1, get a time machine. 2, go back to when you were 6 years old. 3, take golf lessons. 4, become obsessed with golf at the expense of schoolwork, your social life, and family obligations. 5, practice for hours a day. 6, oh yeah, it helps if you're a naturally gifted athlete, maybe in the top 100th of 1% of humanity. If this is not a convenient program for you, let's discuss Plan B. But first, we must do some preparatory mental groundwork. In the introduction to Five Lessons, Hogan mentions that by the time he turned pro at the age of 18, he had hit hundreds of thousands of practice shots. If you, the reader, are 30 years old or older and have not yet hit hundreds or thousands of practice shots, you're not going to catch up to Ben. Hogan continued to be a practice fiend the rest of his life, even when he stopped playing in tournaments. He used to go to his country club and hit ball after ball in the practice area. Hogan paid a kid to stand out there and shag each shot. Given Hogan's reputation, he probably didn't pay the kid a lot. Discussion questions. True insight of Ben Hogan's personality and a couple of questions. The following really happened. Early in his career, pro golfer Mark O'Meara signed a deal to endorse Ben Hogan golf clubs. O'Meara went to Fort Worth, home of Hogan and his company. Mark was met by some VP and sent out to the practice range to try out his new set of clubs. While he was hitting balls, Hogan came out and stood behind the practice tee. Ben didn't bother introducing himself, said nothing to O'Meara, and just stood there with his arm folded, watching the nervous golfer hit ball after ball. Finally, O'Meara paused and looked back to Hogan to see if he'd get any comment. "Awful!" Hogan said. Then he walked away. That was the total conversation Hogan had with O'Meara. So, here are the questions. Do you still think you would have liked to take a lesson from Ben Hogan? That's how he treated a pro golfer who he was paying to use his Hogan golf clubs. Is that who you want teaching you how to play golf? In a book? From the grave? Suggested rule change number 5. A 15th club is allowed. It is an extra putter, just in case. If you're wondering why, refer to suggested rule changes 1, 2, and 3. Keep Mark O'Meara in mind. He'll appear again. Chapter 8. 5 lessons at work in real life. I play with a wonderful man who is in his 80s. He reads Hogan's book all the time. Here's how his swing resembles Hogan's. They are, or were, both human beings. They used a golf club to advance the ball. In the interest of full disclosure, my friend usually advances the ball. There is the occasional whiff. Like every person in their 80s, he doesn't have the flexibility he used to have. He can't turn his hips or shoulders or flex his knees the way Hogan mandates. His swing is all arms. He tries to make up for the lack of flexibility by whipping his arms very fast because he's obsessed with club head speed, a topic we'll cover in depth. The resulting swing is the Jack Nicholson axe murderer move. As one key component of the axe murderer swing, this guy pretty much stops the club right after he hits the ball. There is a 2-inch follow-through. His body tells him, "You chopped down the door with the axe. Why keep swinging? You just hurt yourself." But in his mind, he had the perfect flowing follow-through that is illustrated in 5 lessons. This is what I scientifically refer to as the mind-body delusion. Your mind is convinced you just swung like Hogan, but your body merely executed the axe murderer move. Another note on Ben Hogan. Ben was being himself. I won't go into his terrible childhood and why he might have acted the way he did. He was just writing a book, trying to make a few bucks when 5 Lessons was written in 1957. I would guess he didn't think the book would be the best-selling golf book on Amazon in 2021. In 1957, Amazon was just a river, for one thing. Jeff Bezos wasn't born until 1964. What is interesting is the cult that grew up around the book. In 5 Lessons, the section on the grip, how to hold a club, is 19 pages long, including many illustrations. If you go for a lesson, you can learn the traditional overlapping grip, how to hold a club, in maybe a minute, if you're a slow learner. Because of injuries, I sometimes use a baseball grip. I pick up the club like it's a baseball bat. Ben Hogan would howl at the moon if he saw this grip. It took me about 2 seconds to figure it out. Note for second edition. Several months ago, I got a new primary care physician. I went for my annual exam. He knew I wrote the book, so we talked about golf. It turns out he reads the Hogan book over and over. I asked him his handicap. He's a 3. Then the doctor told me that he planned to read the section on the grip that very night. I said, "You're a 3, and you don't know how to hold the expletive deleted club?" There's a long pause in our conversation. Doctors are not used to their patients talking to them like that. I can get away with saying rude things. I used the brain surgery as an excuse. He did have my medical history right there in front of him. It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card. Finally, I asked, "How old were you when you started playing?" Answer, 4 years old, and he hadn't been a college baseball player. I told him those were the reasons he was a 3 handicap, not that he read the book. We reached an uncomfortable stalemate. He thinks I'm wrong. He's a member of the Hogan cult. During subsequent visits, we have been very wary of one another and squint at each other like a couple of Clint Eastwoods. I'm pretty sure he's given me the correct medications. Back to my 80-year-old friend. Here's a typical conversation when we're standing at the driving range prior to teeing off. "Friend, I read Hogan's book last night. Here's what he says about the grip. Blah, 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 blah. Me. Oh, the Hogan grip, huh? I try hard not to listen. Now we advance to the first tee. My friend hits a hard slice grounder tee shot, maybe 30 yards. Me? In which chapter does Hogan recommend the grounder off the tee? There's a plaque embedded right in the middle of the 18th fairway at the Fable Marion Golf Club. It's around 210 yards from where the pin was that day. The plaque commemorates Ben Hogan's one iron that he hit to 40 feet from the pin, which eventually led to him winning the 1950 U.S. Open. The crowd roared, "The shot," made headlines around the nation, and there's an iconic black and white photo, the kind Life magazine used to run when legendary giants roamed the earth. Let me restate that in a slightly different way. Hogan's shot, which was considered so epic that there's a plaque in the fairway, was a 210-yard one-iron. Bryson DeChambeau would use a 7-iron to hit that same shot, and ending up 40 feet from the hole would be considered just okay. Bryson would not get a plaque, his caddy would replace the divot, and the crowd would not roar. What's the point? The golf has changed, especially the clubs and the golf balls. It's easy to hit the ball with modern equipment, and it goes a lot farther. Golf clubs in Hogan's day resembled medieval torture instruments. Today's clubs for amateurs are much more forgiving of an off-center hit. You don't have to swing like Hogan, you can't move your body as he dictates, and you shouldn't even try. But the average golfer has read Hogan's book and plays with the same $5 golf balls that the pros use. But the average golfer still stinks. Why? Delusional. You're trying to play the wrong game. There's a quote that motivational speakers just love to use. Good is the enemy of great. It means that people settle for good enough instead of striving for greatness. These motivational speeches are given at company meetings, and the boss who paid a big fee to the speaker is trying to flog more work out of the sales force he perceived to be lazy, worthless, money-sapping, drunken liars who waste all their time doing online gambling and asking for more time off for trivial things like the births of their children. I have a different outlook when it comes to golf for the vast majority of people, including me. I'm not going to be great. I'm not going to win the green jacket. Here's a quote I want you to live by. Good enough is better than dog droppings. Right now, your golf game is dog droppings. When you get to consistently good enough, you can think about going further. Or you could just continue being delusional. Discussion question for Chapter 8. Are there any other areas of your life where you're as delusional as you are about your golf game? If so, are you allowed to handle sharp instruments? Question 2. Don't you think that Bryson DeChambeau wearing that Ben Hogan-style cap is a bit much? Assuming no retaliation, wouldn't you like to smack him upside the head and knock that hat right off? Suggested rule change. You are sitting in the fairway after hitting a good tee shot on a par 5. You dead pull your next shot into a tree and it strikes hard, makes a big solid bonk, and bounces straight back almost to your feet. Another member of your foursome asked you, Hey, what club did you hit? Your tree wood? This is actually pretty funny. But remind the jokester that under the new rules, he is only allowed to say that once per round. Bonus question. Would you like to go to the 18th hole at Marion Golf Club in Pennsylvania and try the shot Ben Hogan made? You know, just plop your ball down near the plaque and go for it? Me too. Big deal. They wouldn't let us on the course. They wouldn't even let us in the parking lot. Chapter 9.